audio, MP3 files, on excerpts from the book, Coevolution, Book of Alec Newald, New Zealand, from the early 90s. Here gathered the content from the bibliotcarpliards.net, where also to find some illustrations. Part 1. Chapter 1. 10 Days Go Astray. I used to love driving long distances. Driving a car is one of the few things I seem to have a natural talent for doing. In stating this, it is not my intention to be boastful, but simply to inform you that I feel very comfortable behind the wheel of a car, any car. I do not usually have to pay much attention to the technical aspects of driving a motor vehicle. In other words, I have the tendency to daydream a little when I'm driving. I have found this more likely to happen if the trip is one that is especially familiar to me. Upon further study, I now know this is not a totally uncommon phenomenon. Perhaps you have experienced it occasionally yourself. If so, try to imagine a similar feeling stretched out over a 10-day period. This may give you some idea of how I felt upon reaching my destination at the end of my 200-kilometer drive in the summer of 1989. Auckland City, a major metropolis in the northern region of my homeland, New Zealand, was my destination on that trip, while my starting point was a small but very popular tourist town called Rotorua. I had been living in Rotorua with my family for just over a year but had spent the rest of my life in or very close to Auckland City. The Rotorua, Auckland drive should have taken 3 hours at the most, on any other day but the one in question, as it turned out. The fact 10 days had somehow slipped by during the course of this journey was something I did not even realize at first, though it wasn't long before it became blatantly obvious to me. I can remember that when I arrived in Auckland I was feeling extremely tired, my heart was racing and my mouth dry. If I didn't know better, I would say I had just run the marathon. As is understandable under the circumstances, my stomach had a knot in it the size of a cow. I had the feeling that this was not really happening to me. I was truly in a daze for some time, and nothing seemed quite real, as hard as that is to explain. Things seemed to be happening around me in slow motion, but that was only half of it. Crazy things were going on even days later, things like turning right at intersections when I should have been turning left. Because of this I was getting lost in the city, a place where I had spent the greater part of my life growing up. Smaller things, like not knowing in which hand to hold my knife or fork, and other coordination difficulties I dismissed in the end as just part of the overall side effects of my marriage breakup. This went on for some considerable time, and I would have to say I am not altogether clear of it now. It was almost as if I had been turned inside out or back to front. Amongst the confusion of all the above manifesting itself upon me, I made the minor discovery that the middle of February had now become the end of February. I had left Rotorua on a Monday, so the following day in Auckland should have been a Tuesday. As it turned out, the following day was a Thursday. What had happened to the Tuesday and Wednesday? As I was investigating this puzzle, I found that I was residing in the last week of February, which was impossible because it was only mid-February when I had left Rotorua on the Monday 3 days before. It appeared that I had lost not only Tuesday and Wednesday of 1 week, but the Tuesday and Wednesday of the previous week and all the ensuing days as well. I could not explain how I had fed myself for those 10 days. When I left Rotorua I had $100 in cash on me. Of that, I spent $40 putting fuel into my car, and I'm sure I still had all the rest, $60, in my pocket on arrival in Auckland. I did not use my bank card. I did not have 10 days of bearded growth on my face, either. Where had I been and what had I been up to for those 10 days? Why could I no longer tell my right from my left? Why had the clock in my car stopped working and why did it show the same time as my wristwatch, which was also no longer operational? They had both stopped at approximately 10:30 a.m. All this time, one particular phrase kept running through my head, an interest in motorsport. What it was doing in there I did not know. I definitely have an interest in motorsport. But why should I remind myself of it? Surely I had more important things to think about. At that stage I had still not found a flat or place of my own and was staying with friends. Sleep was not easy to come by and I spent many a late night sitting up in bed reading. One night, while searching a weekly newspaper for accommodation advertisements as much as anything else, I came across a section which contained ads from people looking for partners or friendly contacts. I was skimming down the columns when one particular ad caught my eye. It read, "Interests include motorsport." I got a funny sort of feeling deep down inside. I had to reply to this one. And so Gay Yuen was introduced into my life. If I told you she has incredibly large, sky, blue eyes and is only a touch over 5 feet tall, it would probably not mean too much at this point in my narration, but I'm sure you will get the connection in good time. Finding a place to live was more difficult than I'd first thought, and right about then, as if in sympathy with me, my car decided that it, too, would go through a rough patch. Trouble had already started with the fuel injection system even before the trip up from Rotorua was over. I'd quickly had to deal with that problem, but over the next few weeks other problems appeared, mainly with hydraulic seals. So I decided to sell it. As it turned out, this was my first in a long series of mistakes that would alter my life forevermore. Not long after selling the car, I had a rather mysterious and uninvited visit from two gentlemen who claimed they were scientists from the DSA, Department of Scientific and Industrial Research. Of all things, they wanted to know where the car, and I, had been of late, whether it had been in an accident involving a power pole of high voltage electrical fields, and whether any electronic welding had been done on it in the recent past. They even wanted to know if anyone had worked on the fuel injection system recently. To say they took me by surprise would be an understatement, and I could only answer no to most of their questions. When I could tell them nothing that would satisfy their curiosity, their attitude changed markedly, and not for the better. They showed me a photo, supposedly of my former car's injection fuel, MX circuitry board, but it was an exact mirror image of what should have been fitted, or so they said. I was about to mention the odd things I'd been experiencing over those past few weeks, when something within made me stop. No, this was not the time, and these were not the people to be discussing it with. I almost took a step back myself as this puzzling but dominant attitude took residence in my head. So I kept quiet about the unusual side effects I was experiencing, not to mention my most recent discovery that 10 days had disappeared from my life on a 200-kilometer drive up from Rotorua. One of the two men had shown me a card with a duly stamped Sir or similar logo upon it. On the other side of his leather card holder was a card with a very impressive seal or crest. It read as something along the lines of the Royal Institute for International Affairs, as best I can remember. Since then I have discovered that such an institution does exist in Great Britain. This particular man certainly spoke with an upper-class English accent. There was something about him, though, that grated on me, possibly because of the way he was almost speaking down to me. I'm not sure, but the feeling lingered long after they had gone. I have since found out that scientists were probably the last thing these gentlemen were. However, I shall continue to refer to them as this because I have no other appropriate name or description for them. These two scientists promised to return. I had visions of having to refund all the money to my recent buyer and having to take the car back, but I had already spent some of that money and could not replace it. If such a scenario were to take place, it would be somewhat embarrassing financially. I decided to up stakes and leave. If I had to move, I thought it best in this case to leave no forwarding address and to make it as difficult as possible for anyone to trace me. The vibrations from the last encounter and interview were different from anything I had ever before experienced. There seemed to be something different about the way I perceived things. It was as if I could see right through the false front put up by my visitors. Of course, at the time I had no idea it was a false front. I had always been a quite trusting person, so I found this newly acquired skill, or, rather instant distrust, a little bewildering. That feeling seemed to be more than justified when a few weeks later, to my surprise, the same two scientists appeared at my doorstep. This time they seemed even more sinister and much more insistent. I have no idea how they found me so quickly, but it troubled me to think that they could. I told them there was nothing I could remember that would add to our previous discussion, and asked them to leave me alone. They gave me funny looks and left reluctantly. A day or two later, I was sure my flat had been broken into. A curious little crystal was missing, one of a pair that I found in my car after that very long trip up from Rotorua. They were of the type known as iron pyrites, shaped like a cube or dice and the color of gold. It may even be known to you as fool's gold. On closer inspection, I realized that some of my papers were missing. Amongst them were some sketches and odd doodles I had been making lately. I think I should mention at this point that I have since read all about the mysterious men in black who reportedly so often turn up after UFO sightings or similar events, and I would have to say that these fellows, my visitors' scientists, did not really seem to fit the bill. The moving seemed to have worked this time. Weeks went by and my mystery men did not return. But then I was having strange intrusions from a different source, a dream that would not go away. Not since I was a young boy had such a persistent dream haunted me. In the context of this adventure, I was yet to find out that there is no such thing as coincidence. But it was not the dream so much as the persistent night-time headaches. When these headaches awakened me, I was always partway through the same dream. Eventually, intrigued by the message that seemed to be contained in the dream, and with the consistent vivid reality of it all making me feel like I was really there, living in this other world, I took to keeping notepaper by my bed. A feeling of great loneliness encroached upon me. I was so disturbed and uncomfortable at night that in the end I asked Bob, the friend with whom I stayed on first moving up from Rotorua, if I could once again impose on his hospitality for a few days. This worked up to a point, but the dream persisted. Meanwhile, back in the bedroom, I had amassed quite a stack of scribbling from my ongoing nightly episodes. Then one night, out of the blue, I received an important new message which ended this sequence of dreams. I felt I was free at last, but strange things were still happening to me in a physical sense. If I chose to wear a wristwatch, its battery would go flat in just a few weeks. This was still happening to a lesser degree even as recently as 1993. I had a distinct feeling from within that something was quite wrong, both medically and mentally. A subsequent medical test suggested nothing was amiss, apart from the fact that I had a slightly unusual blood type. At home, I played around with my scribbling from the dream, trying to make some sense out of them. There were a few clues that seemed to tie it to those lost 10 days, but I was still far from putting all the pieces together. As with all dreams, it darted about and it was hard to find a common, consistent theme to it all. One time soon afterwards, it was as if someone else was guiding the pen, the gaps began to fill, the story started to flow and make sense. I could hardly believe what I was writing. This is how I believe my adventure began. Chapter 2. Ghosts in the Machine. It was approximately 10 o'clock on a midsummer TMS day when I set out on this journey. I remember the first section only too well, and do not need prompting from dreams or any other outside influence. The weather was passable when I left Rotorua, but my route took me through some rugged hill country, and a fine misty rain set in at this higher altitude. Those of you who have gone through a marriage separation will not need to be told how it feels. I felt numb, sick, and in some sort of daze. It really did feel like there were two parts of me, an inner part and an outer portion. The innermost part was heavy, very heavy. The outer part seemed to be in slow motion, assessing the options. There was no deep thinking going on here, just options being considered. The weather now seemed to be in the same frame of mind, for what at first was light rain and low cloud was now a mixture of thick fog, unusual for that time of day. It appeared to be sticking to the car as if trying to hold it back. I didn't EMT really wanted to leave the area, even though I knew I had to. If my other, outer self was sending out a message for help, I suspect it would have been heard in the next galaxy. Perhaps it was. Visibility was now no more than 50 or 100 meters. It was almost like being in a dream. Slowly, an even stranger feeling came over me. The best description I can give is that it felt like I was being immersed in a slow, setting glue. My vision became blurred and the steering wheel began to hum in my hands. There is a vague notion in the back of my mind that the road itself was vibrating. Then I got the fright of my life. The steering wheel appeared to lock solid. There was no time to debate the issue, for a large rock face was looming up in front of me and there seemed to be no way I could avoid hitting it. This is all I can remember of the physical trip in a reality that could be described as conventional, apart from my eventual arrival in Auckland 10 days later. What happened in those 10 days of 8 missing time ETM I would now like to share with you. Having for all intents and purposes passed through the cliff face, I found myself devoid of car, and, what a TMS more, devoid of body. All the solid things appeared to have gone, yet there was still a feeling I could walk. Looking down, I noticed that a glassy or icy type of substance was prevalent. This ice, like floor had a whitish look to it, as if lit from below. I got the impression it was cold, but I was not sure if I had the necessary equipment to sense temperature. This was curious because there also appeared to be heat involved, perhaps emanating from the ring of soft, blue light that appeared to surround me, even if this light source looked to be some distance off. Before long I found I could travel in any direction simply by looking that way and pushing forward with what would have been my head, if I had possession of such a thing. Eventually, and most likely because I was becoming acclimatized to the low light level and whatever other transformation my body may have been going through, it was possible for me to make some ghost-like entities moving about in the far distance. There seemed to be a faint golden glow about them. I looked down to see if there was any similarity between them and me, but it was difficult to be sure. As time passed, it became easier for me to see, almost as if a fog was lifting around me. Other distant objects came into focus or view in more and more detail. There was no way at that time to be sure just how large an area this may have been, but I should think that a football field, or even two, could have been placed within it. No doubt this blue ring of light was responsible for the bluish haze that appeared earlier. I thought I could detect the very faint smell of ozone, as if the air had been ionized, as well as that carbon type smell emitted by electric motors while they are running. I seem to be taking this very well, was the last of my conscious thoughts before I had the distinct feeling that someone was tapping me on my shoulder. Turning around, I found myself face to face with two of the ghost-like entities. Throughout this entire procedure, if I am correct in calling it that, there was an air of complete tranquility. If culture shocks were the order of the day, they were not over yet. As we passed the ring of neon light that seemed to encircle us, I suddenly regained a normal type body and so did the other entities, or at least that a TMS what I thought at the time. There seemed to be some time loss factor here and, quite likely at this time, there were other things that I was not aware of that may have happened to me. It was a little embarrassing to realize that my clothes had not come along for the ride. But it definitely was the 8-meter TM I had become used to over the last 40 years. The two humanoid creatures I followed appeared to be female, or, should I say, they had all the parts that the female ZATMD most recently been in contact with have. All these parts appeared to be in the right places, too. They only wore what looked like some sort of plastic coating or very tight, fitting suit. Their entire bodies were, head to toe, a light blue, grey color. The covering certainly did not leave anything to the imagination. I remember finding this rather comforting at the time. In amongst this very strange and alien environment, they, their color aside, were at least vaguely familiar to me. They had some other features that were unusual and of note, including a lack of noticeable hair on any part of their bodies, and a slightly disproportionately larger head and eyes than I would consider normal for a human. One of the entities moved toward what looked like a clear glass cabinet, indicating she wanted me to step in it. As I did so, It adjusted to my chin level. At the same time, something else came down from above, but I couldn't see it clearly. Then, on looking down, I found that I, too, had gained a plastic body, suit or skin and taken on a blue, grey appearance. From this I deduced that my female companions may well have a skin colour similar to mine beneath their suits. Interestingly, I now had no body, hair. It was not so quite clear to me what would happen should I desire to go to the toilet. Perhaps there would be no need from here on in. This later proved to be a good guess. There was no way I could know if the plastic skin covered my head as it did theirs, and there was no mirror handy. The entire suit was also impossible to feel. For all intents and purposes it wasn't there, but it gave me complete freedom of movement. Although I had regained my body, there was no way I could make any sound come out. Eventually one of them made contact with me. The taller of the two somehow put the thought inside my head that, should I like to follow her, she would take me to a place where it would be more comfortable and possible for me to communicate with others of my time, span. There are two ways to describe this creature who stood before me. If I were indeed dead, she might be an angel, albeit without wings. Whether this meant I had gone up or down, I didn't know. If not an angel, then what, an alien? This would be the harder of the two options to check out, I thought. After all, what should or does an alien look like? She most certainly did not look remotely like descriptions I had seen and read about in the odd magazine or Sunday paper. These sources gave descriptions of aliens that were only 4 feet or less in height, mostly with quite large heads and huge black eyes, hardly any nose, mouth or ears, and stick-like arms and legs. Apart from the fact she was rather small in stature, this, dare I say, beautiful creature was almost 5 feet tall, with alluring violet, blue eyes, slightly wider apart than usual and turned up at the outside. They were almost oriental in appearance, but much, much larger, not unlike those Egyptian wall paintings. She had a fine, featured, impish face with a narrow jaw, line and small but well-defined mouth and lips. Her neck was rather longer than usual for her size, but it was accentuated by her sloping shoulders. The bodysuit, if that a TMS what it was, enabled me to see a perfectly formed set of small breasts, followed by a very fine waist. She had fine, long, fingered, five-digit hands and rather frail-looking legs, once again more in keeping with those of a young child. Her head was a bit fuller at the back, but there was not that much which could not be passed off as puterrestrial. I was later to learn that her appearance was not the only thing about her that was more than outstanding. On following her, we eventually arrived at an area that looked rather like a bowling alley. It had 10 or so pathways leading off a semi-transparent floor. There was a strange resistance emanating from most of the alley ways, but none from the last. It was at this one that we stopped. "You may wish to link with some of your fellow beings in here," she said without actually saying anything. "I will be back in a short space of your time with some helpful instructions from my guardian." She continued on her way without looking back, leaving me somewhat stunned and standing at the junction of the path leading to the last alley way. At no stage of my interaction with these creatures did I receive any direct order, only suggestions. I did not yet fully comprehend what had happened or was still happening to me. The fact that I had been left alone in a strange place without a guard meant that either they trusted me or there was little I could do that worried them, probably the latter. This just had to be a dream. What else could it be? I thought, trying to reassure myself. In the morning ETMD awaken at home as usual with the family, and all I would have would be a fading memory of this crazy stuff. Her guardian? My mind was sliding back to the present situation. Wonder what that means. Sounds a bit formal. Chapter 3. Transports of Delight. At the end of the pathway was what appeared to be a solid door. I waited for a short time, half expecting it to open automatically. When it became obvious this was not going to happen, I began pondering my options. I decided to reach out and run my hand over the door. On doing this, I was startled to find that my hand went right through the door. Again I pondered my options. In the end I threw caution to the wind, and through the door went all of me. I was now in an area that was more familiar to me, in as much as the odd glass-like structures from before had been replaced by a less translucent material, more like solid plastic than anything else. I was in a room with items of furniture that looked like tables and chairs. The only things that were strikingly different about them was their rounded, smooth appearance with no sharp corners. Even the room, if you could call it that, was circular in shape. There were figures across the far side of this A-Marina-TM, and I made off towards them with a little more confidence than I displayed the last time I saw figures in the distance. In this instance, they appeared to be wearing the same sort of plastic-type bodysuit as I had been fitted with. Encouragingly, they also appeared more human in proportion than my recent escort. "Welcome," was the message that entered my head. A woman seemed to be communicating with me. She was standing next to a table, like piece of furniture upon which was something that could only be described as a circular three-dimensional picture display. "My name is TMS Millie," she added. Once again I attempted to speak, but nothing came out. "Don't you TMT try so hard, just think it," she suggested. "What am I doing here?" I managed to get out, so I was told. "Weren't ma just lucky, I think," said Millie. "Weren't ma aboard a lightship, a transporter?" "Well, it's RTMS more complicated than that," she said, but did not explain any further. "EATMM here because I chose to be, and because of the length of time I have been here I can no longer go back, to Earth. That is," she added. "What about me, can I go back?" I asked. "I should think so, but EATMM not sure. Only the Guardian can tell you that." "Why did you not go back?" I asked. "I chose to stay because that is what I wanted. This Guardian fellow, who or what is it?" I asked. "Well, ATMS more than one, but ATMM not sure how many. They run the ship, in fact. They are not only of a higher rank but they are quite different. I must warn you, Guardians are not at all like the Mark II models, as we call them. The ones you would have seen when you came aboard. They are only responsible for general duties. These Guardians, or Elders, as they are sometimes called, are very powerful but you need not fear them. It's RTMS only when they come to our atmosphere," Millie continued, "that you can get sucked in here. As close as I can describe it, it's RTMS a bit like being sucked into a radio signal or, in your generation, a TV signal, and then spat out into the viewing room. You were unlucky to be zapped in here on an outward trip, unless, of course, they planned it that way. If you will look here," she pointed to the three-dimensional device EATMD spotted earlier. "That small dot there is probably our sun, and that ATMS how I knew we were on an outward journey. EATMD been following our progress just before you came in. Once we get clear of our system ATMLL be able to see the other side of yourself, just for a short time. Will it ever be a surprise? ATMLL know when it happens, believe me, but ATMLL let them explain what that ATMS all about. Then we at TMLL be close to their home base or planet. That should be a sight for you as at RTMS your first time with us," Millie suggested. "How long will I have to wait until they come back?" I asked hesitantly. "Well, not as long as you may think. Was anyone expecting you? Have you family waiting?" she asked. "Some friends in Auckland, but I did not say exactly when I would arrive. At least I don't yet TMT think so. It all seems to be a long time, like it was in some other lifetime." Even though I was in the middle of this conversation with Millie, it didn't TMT really feel like it was me who was the standing talking. Now EATMM talking to someone WOTMS about 100 years old and doesn't TMT look a day over 40. Look at that viewing screen, that a TMS out of Star Trek or beyond. EATMV never seen anything like it before in my life. "Are you still with us?" Millie asked, interrupting my daydream. As I meant to add before, the Elders have been experimenting with some form of genetic engineering on these Mark II models. Well, They are Mark 3 and Mark 4, actually.